Podcast City Network. The Everett Lee Show.
Welcome to the Everett Lee Show. I'm the Everett Lee. I want to give a shout out to everyone that follows me on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, Everett Lee Show. And of course, Podcast City Network, the official host of the Everett Lee Show. Podcast City Network, your top source for independent podcasts. And be creative, be yourself. I have a great podcast here tonight lined up on this Tuesday evening here. I have two great guests right now standing by in the green room here on video chat. First off, I want to welcome to the podcast. First time coming on a podcast. You may have seen him in movies from Son of the South, MTV's Teen Wolf, and Delirium. Actor Mike Manning. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, how's it going? Good to see you.
Pretty good. Next up, I have director of films such as Black Weight, The Saddest, and Painkiller. Back for a third time on the podcast, ladies and gentlemen. I want to welcome back to the Everett Lee Show, none other than Jeremiah Kemp. How you doing, hey, Jeremiah?
Hey, Everett. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's great to have both you on here tonight talking about the movie that I've been waiting for a long time. I was talking with you right before going live here, Jeremiah, about it, that Slapface, it's finally out exclusively on the Shudder Network, man. I am so happy about this, and I know you guys are pretty happy about it too, with it finally being released.
Oh, over the moon. We're so happy that we found a home at AMC Shudder.
It's excellent, man. I definitely love it, man. I've been reading reviews of it, and I was sharing with Jeremiah, Mike, before you joined. I wrote some notes for over the weekend because I went ahead and I watched it. And during this podcast, I'll throw in there some of my chicken scratch notes. So I'm excited to, you know, jump right into this, man, and you know, start talking about this. I do want to ask you this, Mike, how long you been in the business?
Started acting when I was younger. I was 13. I did community theater. I acted in high school. For me, I never really knew any other actors in Colorado. I didn't have any professional actors in my orbit. So for me, it was always something I loved to do, but it was more of a hobby. And then I moved to Los Angeles 11 years ago to pursue acting professionally, and been here ever since.
Wonderful actor, though. I met him through a fellow producer named Joe Benedetto, who knew that Mike was not only an actor but a producer. Mike's produced other films that he's acted in, and they were looking for horror projects. And as it turned out, I was very fortunate because Slapface, the short film, which was a proof of concept, had been doing the festival circuit for about 3 years, and they'd heard of us through the reviews we'd received and the awards we received, and I was ready. Like when Mike asked to read the script, we showed the proof of concept and the short film and the pitch deck and the script, and when Mike read it, I think it was exactly what he was looking for.
How did you find out about it? How'd you get involved with it? How did that happen on your end, on your side?
Yeah, it was very much the stars aligning. I had produced another horror thriller and fell in love with that genre as a producer. And I reached out to some friends and said, hey guys, I'm looking for a thriller, you know, horror, and, you know, send me scripts. And a mutual friend of Jeremiah and I's, Joe Benedetto, said, I have this writer-director that has a short film. He wrote a feature version of it. Do you want to read it? And
okay.
Then connected with Jeremiah. And the idea of working together.
Yeah, I'd seen some of the stuff that Mike had produced. There was a great movie called MFA, which he had a supporting role in. But that sounded like it was kind of like something that Mike had helped to nurture into existence. And just watching that movie, I knew that Mike was interested in character-driven stories with complicated themes. He's also made a number of documentaries that I thought were really superb, dealing with like really important issues like homeless youth in America. And I think that some of the themes of abuse and bullying in Slapface really spoke to Mike. It fit in with his idea of telling a very entertaining story. So come for the monster, but stay for the difficult complexity of how to deal with the moral ambiguities and the, frankly, the emotional challenges of bullying and child abuse, which I don't think are cut and dry issues. I don't think that bullying can be solved by Arnold Schwarzenegger coming in and punching someone in the nose. It's right. There's more to it than that. And I think that that's what Mike responded to in the story. And in fact, I'll let Mike pick it up from here. But like, he proposed a change in the script that at first I had pushback against, but it turned out to be this incredible idea. And once I accepted it, it really took the story in a really bold new direction that fit the themes that we're talking about. I mean, it made it more and more morally complex and more morally ambiguous. In the short and in the feature length script, it was a father and son story, mm-hmm. where the mother was gone. And Mike said, well, what if, why don't you tell me what you proposed?
Yeah. If my internet holds up, I'll continue.
I'll pick it up if it increases.
Yeah. So when I first read the script, I loved the story and I loved exactly what Jeremiah said. This had everything good about a horror thriller. It had the witch, it had the boy, it had the solitude that he's feeling. It also had an anti-bullying element to it, which I really connected with. And it was originally a father and son story. And I went to Jeremiah and I said, Jeremiah, I want this decision, but how do you feel about this story being two brothers? Because not only did I fall in love with the script, I fell in love with the character of Tom. And I said, how do you feel about the story being two brothers? You know, sit with this. I want this to be a mutual decision. I don't want you to feel pressured in anything. But I pitched my case. I thought that it added a level of sadness to the fact that this little boy is not only he's not feeling alone because of the death of his mother and then the fathers. Like, we've seen characters of alcoholic fathers before. We've seen characters of like a bad father, a neglectful father. But to me, there was so much more meat to the story if it was an older brother figure that was sort of thrust into parenthood with no roadmap and no skills or tools to be a guardian, but he genuinely thought he was doing the right thing. And that's what I think we captured in the film, and what audiences are responding to is the relationship between the two brothers. Tom, my character, genuinely thinks that he is preparing his little brother for how hard the real world is. He slaps him in his face because he thinks that is his way of showing discipline, and that is his way of having structure and preparing his brother for a world that has so far been very unkind to both of them. So yeah. I feel like that adds an element to the story that a father and son story wouldn't necessarily have had.
Yeah, because I wrote down on my notes here, the opening credits, disturbing a bit, because right there, that beginning, when they're playing Slapface, I shrieked. It's like the hair on my arm just rose because it just gave me goosebumps. I'm like, oh man. And yeah. just as you hit it right there, you hit it like right on the head there, because I felt like Tom was trying everything he could that he thought was the best possible way to raise Lucas and be that, filling in the shoes for the parents. And it's like, at the same time too, I still seen that brother, big brother, younger brother relationship, which I got too, because I have like five brothers. They're all older than me. And pretty much I related to that. Like, I know how my big brothers are. I know how they treat me. So I, right then and there, I'm like, I could feel that, man. I definitely feel that.
With the opening credits, we didn't want to pull any punches, so to speak. We wanted the audience just the audience to know exactly the movie that they were getting into in the first couple minutes. It was like this is what the movie's about. To me, this isn't a feel good movie. This is a feel something movie. And yeah, by the end of the movie, we want people to walk away feeling something about Tom, about Lucas, about the monster, about the community, about the, above and beyond some of the other conversations that we've been talking about in interviews of like, is the witch real? Is the witch not real? You know, all these other things. But we didn't want to pull any punches. In some ways, the movie is a slow burn. So we wanted to take advantage of the opening credits to really tell the story of the witch and to tell this, you know, to really sort of buckle the audience down and say, this is the movie that you're in for. We're going to open on a couple slaps across the face.
Oh, yeah. I felt it, man. I felt it there. And then when I was watching opening credits there and I've seen stuff about, I'm probably going to say this wrong here, Virgo. When I saw it, I was like, okay, this is pretty much laying out what the credits are, because I've seen movies where the opening credits basically laid out the whole story. And if you didn't pick up on it, then you wouldn't know. You have to watch it twice. And right away, I saw that and I'm like, okay, I seen that. And I said, yeah, this is pretty much laying out the whole story there. But talking about the character Tom, man, Mike, what did you draw from that character? Because he was, to me, when I seen Tom, he was just so emotional and has not gotten over the fact that, you know, Tom and Lucas's parents died. And I felt that was weighing a lot on him too, because again, you know, filling the parents' role, filling those shoes there. How did you mentally like prepare yourself when you're reading the script there? You're like, okay, all right, this is who Tom's going to be. How did you mentally set yourself into that role?
I think first and foremost, what needed to happen was I had to build chemistry with August Maturo as my little brother, as Lucas. And immediately, I mean, we just lucked out with August. He was such a gift to the film, and he understood the genre because of his experience with The Nun. He understood horror and the story we were trying to tell, but he also had this incredible work ethic because of his time as a Disney star on Girl Meets World, you know, and just being raised as a child actor. So he came to set and immediately we became friends, and he wanted to do such a good job that I felt protective over him immediately. And, you know, we would hang out between takes, we would tell jokes, and we just sort of developed this brotherly connection. And so that was number one. And then number two is, in my life, I have experienced people that have dealt with substance abuse, have also dealt with loss, and, you know, some of the real human things that happened in Jeremiah's script. And so combining the two together and just trying to be in the moment, literally the cast and the crew, we all stayed basically at this area called Willow Lakes in upstate New York, and that's where we filmed. So half the time we would wake up and walk to set, and we would walk to the forest, or we would walk to wherever we were filming. And to save money, but also to stay in character, I slept in Tom's bed, the actual character's bed. When I woke up in the morning, I went and made coffee in Tom's coffee maker. I opened the fridge and got juice out of Tom's fridge. And so for the entirety of production, I was basically living on set 24/7, living in that world. And August and his mom, they had a cottage that was, you know, a 2-minute walk right by the woods. And so August was living in that world. And then Jeremiah was staying with his DP at another cottage, a walk away. And so we were all just sort of living in this little bubble that we were creating in the movie 24/7 for the duration of filming. So it really gave us an opportunity to, I think, find special moments and really feel relaxed in the world that we were creating with each other. The entire time on set.
Wow, that's amazing, man. I like that, man. You got into I love when an actor or actress gets into the character. They get into it. They get into it and they breathe life into this character from paper to screen, man. That's amazing. I love that.
You wish you would have the opportunity to do that more often. It's like often you're staying at a hotel or something like that, and then you travel to the location and there's a bit of a remove between, you know, the cast and the crew and the work that you're doing. But it was so immersive and it created such a feeling of intimacy and trust between all of us. I felt like that translated into the work. You know, the making of the movie is the movie, and a lot of that stuff informed the work. And I feel like the audience picks up on that because they come for a monster movie and they are entertained by all the horror elements of it, but they are also struck by the movie also breaks their heart. And we've heard a lot of responses from festival audiences. And even now I've been hearing from people who saw the movie on Shudder saying they did not expect to be weeping and crying and so emotionally overhauled by the movie, that their hearts were broken by what happened with Lucas and Tom. And that as abusive as Tom is, they're drawn into Tom's story. They're drawn into the fact that he is doing his best. He is really trying to be the father figure. He is really trying to be the best older brother that he can. And his younger brother, you know, it's like, I mean, if you want to, like Tom is the abuser, but there are scenes with Lucas where he does not give back and does not want to talk about his parents' passing. Like when Tom unloads this monologue, essentially trying to reconnect with his brother and remember what happened, Lucas says to him, "I don't want to talk about it. You know, we promised never to talk about that." So in many ways, like Lucas is putting up shields of resistance. I think Tom is trying to break through them with the slap face game. So it's a complex dance that the two brothers have. And I think that the audience winds up really caring for both of the brothers. Even with Tom being the abuser, they start to understand that it's not as simple as, you know, black hat, white hat, good guy, bad guy. You know, it's like the movie is about the mysteries between people and the fact that there's a gray zone between all of us. You know, and the more we get to know someone, the more mysterious they become.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You're talking about when Tom was unloading on Lucas there. Yeah. Mike, that scene right there where you're in the bathtub and you're sitting there, you're like, Lucas, give me my beer. And then he just unloads. I'm like, wow. And then I was just like, he poured his heart out. And then Lucas is like, we said we weren't going to talk about it. It's just so cold. He cold cuts him off. I'm like, whoa. I was like, wow. It's like, man, he finally opened up to you. You know, he opened up to you. You know, big brother opened up to little brother, and little brother just like, eh, you know, when I ain't talking about it, that hit me. I was like, wow.
I worked on that scene with Mike a lot because the script had been written for a really long time. It took a while to get this movie made. And that scene, when we rehearsed it, I remember talking to Mike and saying, Mike, why don't you go away and like really think about the details of the scene? Essentially, I asked Mike to become a writer. So there was a monologue on the page, but I said, think about it. Like, what would make this specific to you? Like, create the story, tell it to me in a minute or less, you know, or whatever. And then we worked on it in rehearsal. And then Mike went away and like really essentially became a writer for that piece of the movie. You know, so all the facts were there, but the personalization of the details and the specificity of what happened that night really came from Mike Manning. And that's a testament to how much I trust him as a creative partner in this project. It was more than a director-producer relationship, but a real partnership between collaborators.
Thank you. I actually thought of you. I went to a screening of Don't Look Up, and they were talking about Adam McKay and Leonardo DiCaprio and how his, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but he breaks down and he sort of goes crazy during this news conference. And during the interview, they said that they sort of let Leo go and rewrite the monologue 15 times, and nobody knew what he was going to say. And he sort of went off in the corner and was down to the very last second. And I had flashbacks of you and I in that bathroom.
Oh, like, wonderful.
Running through the monologue to the very last second. Like, what do I want to say? And the fact that the nice thing about working with Jeremiah is that he gives you all the structure so that you feel safe and you sort of can prepare as an actor, you make your choices and you prepare and you feel that you're keeping up with the energy. You're able to, you know, sort of pass the baton. But at the same time, he gives you enough freedom that you can take risks and you can sort of, I went into that and I literally sat in a bathtub in all of my clothes, not knowing what I was going to say. And I felt like I was okay, because that's real life. We don't know what we're going to say. We don't know what is going to happen from moment to moment. And it was because Jeremiah had said, Mike, just live with this story in your head, live with everything. And just when the cameras roll, just, you know, take your time and say what you want to say. And it was that freedom that I think helped me get there emotionally, to really have my heart broken in front of my little brother in real time, in front of a camera, and then be shot down like that. Like you said.
Yeah. That was a moving scene right there, because I wrote down on my notes here. I said, let's see, where did I put it at right here? Oh, they're basically Lucas and Tom are dealing, grieving in their own ways with the loss of their parents. They definitely were. That's what I took about it, looked at when I was watching this here, that they were grieving in their own way of the loss of their parents, because, I mean, it takes some time to get over a loss. I mean, when you lose someone that's close to you, especially your parents, I can relate to that. I lost my mom just this September. So when I'm watching this here, I was like, I feel their pain, man. I know what they're going through, man. I definitely know what they're going through. And man, like, sorry. Yeah, it's been rough, but I've take one day at a time.
Yeah.
That's all you can do, man. Take one day at a time.
Yeah.
But you're talking about the rest of the cast. How did that come about, Jeremiah? How did the rest of the cast come? How did you come up with getting the rest of this cast here that you surrounded Mike and with Tom and Lucas? How did that come about?
Yeah, well, August, who we've been talking about, who played Lucas, was somebody that was on all of our lists. We had a casting director named Carolyn Sinclair. And what was really great about August was that, you know, we all go away and we make our lists of like, who would be great for the sheriff and who would be great for Anna. And the top of all of our lists for Lucas was August Maturo, which is because he is an extraordinary actor. Like, he's such a interesting, emotionally available, complex person. And, you know, we were very fortunate. We made the offer to August and he was really interested. He wanted to take on a role that was the center of not only a genre film, but that allowed him his full range of emotional complexity.
Right.
Now, Libe Barrere, who plays Anna, was being mentioned by Joe Benedetto pretty much the entire time that we were doing the casting process. Like, you know, Libe Barrere from Sneaky Pete, Libe Barrere from Sneaky Pete. And I watched the show and I was like, yeah, Libe Barrere is really smart. You know, Libe Barrere is a really accomplished actor. And, you know, she, you know, I know that when she read the script, she responded to the human drama of it. She said that it reminded her of Sam Shepard and Tracy Letts and people like that. And I'm not comparing myself to those great writers. It's more that she was like, it's in a world of strange and interesting characters on the fringe, and that her character like was kind of an outsider moving into that world. And I think that really attracted her. Dan Hedaya, of course, has done like hundreds and hundreds of films that we all love. He was the dad in Clueless and in The Usual Suspects.
Yes.
I didn't even think about Dan Hedaya for this movie. We were thinking about other actors. He did not come to mind because I never would have dreamed of working with Dan. I think he's an extraordinary actor. But then, yeah. You know, his agent in Gersh was like, hey, what do you think of Dan? And then I remember that we all stopped and said, oh my gosh, Dan would be amazing in this role. And the way that he liked to work was he was interested in understanding what the entire movie was. He wanted to talk about the themes. He wanted to talk about the emotional underpinnings of the story. He wanted to talk about what the game of Slapface meant to the brothers. And then he wanted to see where he fit into their world, which I thought was really interesting because Dan is also a painter. And I think he thought of himself as a piece of the mosaic, as a tile in a larger mosaic. He was like, how do I fit into your world? which I thought was really exciting and great. And last but not least is Lucas Hassel, who plays the monster. Lucas had been a collaborator of mine for many, many years. Like, he'd acted in several of my films. When we did the short, he played the monster. And when it came time to do the feature, I asked Mike, you know, and the other producers, I said, I'd like to bring Dominic Civilli, who was the director of photography, who shot the film so beautifully, because I've worked with him for 11 years now or something like that. And we're like peanut butter and jelly. We really complement each other very well. And then Lucas Hassel, and they were like, so you want this 6'4" Danish guy to play the witch, this woman, you know, I don't know, you know? And I said, no, please, please trust me. You know, it's like this, you know, Lucas is an enormously physical actor and he will personalize the role and it won't just be like rubber and paint. It will feel like a full character with wants and needs. And without any dialogue, just through the physicality of his body, he will create a sense of intimacy with this character. He will create a yearning in this monster. And indeed, when we did like wardrobe tests with Anna Davis, our great wardrobe designer, you know, I talked to Anna about like creating this very slender robe that looked like the bark of a tree. And then Anna was like, well, what if there's a hood, you know, that's very witch-like and it will like help keep the monster very mysterious. And Lucas Hassel said, well, what if he has a belt with like a bunch of toys and trinkets on it, like such as she might have had from other children. So it was a real collaboration, like everything else on this movie, of creating the monster and like finding its form. And then once Lucas was on set, August bonded with Lucas Hassel immediately. And Mike Manning, you know, was like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like Lucas Hassel giving us so much. Like, it's such a raw physical performance. And I'm really grateful to you, Mike. Thank you for trusting and for allowing us to bring this remarkable actor into the team.
Yeah, that was one of the, I feel like every film has a certain number of trust falls, and Jeremiah vouched for Lucas. And that was one of the biggest things that I was sort of like, okay, I have no idea how this is going to turn out, but I'm just going to trust Maya. And it was exactly that. I'd seen the short film, and Lucas had played Virago or the witch in the short film. And then this, but I was like, wait, yeah, exactly. Like, you want a 6'4" man that's built be this witch. I'm like, what is this? This can't work. But then it was the first scene where I'm sitting there behind the monitor watching playback, and everything down to the way he moves his hands, to the way he moves his face, to the way he maintains eye contact, to the way that he mimics Lucas. He said more than I had ever read on the page without even saying anything. And it was from that day, I was like, Jeremiah, you were right. Like, I'm glad this worked out, because we can't cast anybody else. But now, but I feel like now we have a really special, it's going to be great kind of thing.
it was, man, because one thing I like about the monster was that you could see the monster, but it was more of the shape. You didn't see too much of the face. Everything was, it was, you know, the lighting around the monster was dark, and just to his characteristics, he spoke with his movements, and I noticed that too. Like you pointed out there, Mike, I noticed that, because everything the monster did, it was something from like moving around and stuff, and you can read that body language. And yeah, he did say a lot without saying anything.
And you need a great actor to play the monster, always. I mean, ever since Boris Karloff played Frankenstein, and Doug Jones more recently in Pan's Labyrinth, you know, it's always the thing where it's like, you want a great actor. And then the strange thing is, you need the actor to give a great performance, and then show that character fleetingly, because you always want to see the monster out of the corner of your eye. Like, you know, it's always in the edit, like, how little can we show the monster? And then when you're showing the monster very little, it needs to be incredibly specific. Like, every gesture needs to be incredibly specific. So you're not going to show very much. You need to retain the mystery. But I think the monster is a shared accomplishment of many different departments, because Dominic Civilli had to light it just so, otherwise it looks like rubber and paint. And the sound design by Michael Odemark, was really fascinating to do because Mike Manning and I were just, we were thinking a lot about what if like there's some cicada sounds and what if it sounds like, what if this part sounds like an old woman and what if this part sounds like an animal and what if this part sounds like the wind? And Michael Odemark really, it was a challenge to try to find the voice of the creature. But Michael had seen the short film actually in Portland. We screened our films together in the same film festival. And as fate would have it, when we went to the post house, Michael Odemark was assigned to us. He's like, I remember you. I remember your short film. I handed you my card and I said that I wanted to work on it. And here we are. And it was really delightful because he did a brilliant job. He really cared about his contribution to the monster because in a horror film, sound design and music are really the coin of the realm. You know, if you want to terrify an audience, part of it is great acting because you need the other actors to respond to the creature so powerfully. If you watch Alien, the monster is shown fleetingly and well, but they play a lot of it on Sigourney Weaver and the other brilliant actors in that film. And then a lot is conveyed through sound, through lighting, and through music, which I thought was incredibly important. So it, like the monster is credit to many, many different departments that cared about the creature and the making of the movie.
Yeah, definitely. I want to give a shout out to Ill Will Productions, man. Especially special effects, especially the part here with Anna, when Anna, you know, it was in the house.
No spoilers, but like something happens with Anna. You know, it's there is a strange moment between the monster and Anna. Like the monster encounters many of the characters in the movie, and it's a particularly scary moment. But with Ill Will Defects, I mean, the stuff that we talked about was the witch being a character from fairy tales, you know, with the strange nose and the strange face. But unlike fairy tales, it would be on this giantly, you know, this tall person, you know, so 6'4" Lucas Hassel wearing platforms brings him up to 7 feet tall. Now you've got this like fairy tale, the witch face on this elongated, stretched out body, so that it creates the effect of dysmorphia, where like the human body is stretched. So it's an unnatural shape for this creature, which we thought was really fun. The people who implemented the creature on set were Tony O'Brien and Sandy Washington, both of whom were enormously gung-ho about playing make-believe every day. So they were really on board with how do we make it a fairy tale creature? How do we make her feel like she's from the forest? How do we shape it to Lucas Hassel's face so that we can feel his eyes and we can feel his movements under the prosthetics? Because as I said before, the greatest special effect is a human being. Like once the stuff is on top of an actor, then the actor fills it with meaning. You know, Freddy Krueger is nothing without Robert Englund performing the role under the makeup.
Exactly. That's I totally agree right there with you with it. Like Mike, when seeing everything put together on the monster, when you first seen the monster, what was like, were you like, whoa, what was your reaction to that, man?
It was bizarre. I was relieved when I first saw the monster on camera, because it looked with Dominic's lighting and with Lucas Hassel's performance, the monster just became this creature of its own, like on its own, and this whole presence. And I was relieved. I said, wow, this movie is gonna work because the monster is such a big part of it. And also I was just so impressed with what Lucas Hassel, you know, brought to the character, and immediately saw why Jeremiah had fought for him so much. And that was while the cameras were rolling. While the cameras were not rolling, Lucas would take the hood off and prance around set and skip. And during lunch, sometimes it was bizarre. Sometimes he would have the face on, and he would pull the hood down, and it was just this bald head and this big nose. And he would go through the craft services with like this British accent and pretend to be on a cooking show and would prank everybody and make jokes on the set. And he would run around with his arms out, and you just see this giant terrifying witch creature playing with August, like another 12-year-old boy. And it was just, it was bizarre. And it was fun. It was great.
Take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll dive more into the conversation right here. But first, there's a couple things I do want to mention.
Keep up with the latest shows and content from Podcast City Network over on podcastcity.net. Follow them on facebook.com/podcastcitynetwork, Twitter @podcastcitynet. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, Podcast City Network, and on Twitch, Podcast City Network. Podcast City Network, your top source for independent podcasting. Be creative, be yourself.
Whether it's a sticker for your car, a t-shirt for that special someone, or a neck garter to keep safe during COVID-19, Podcast City Network has you covered. Grab the latest PCN gear today at podcastcity.net/shop to show your support for your favorite show or shows from Podcast City Network today. Want to start a podcast? Trying to grow your current show? Podcast City Network is here to help. We currently offer services for social media advertising, marketing, live stream hosting, custom logo design and branding, transcript services, custom intro and outro videos, audio video editing, press kits, one-on-one consultants, and much more. So don't wait. Contact us today. podcastcity.net/services. Head over to the website, fill out the form, get in contact with Podcast City Network. Have you ever wanted to start a podcast but didn't know how? Do you already have a podcast but you don't know how to grow it? Are you trying to find ways to make your podcast profitable? You can learn how to do it here at Podcast City Network. We offer consultant services, tutorial classes to help with learning to better expand your knowledge to grow your show. We also give access to our network of shows to help with cross promotions, guests, and overall reach while becoming a part of our ever-expanding PCN community based on people helping people. The best part is no membership fee. So what are you waiting for? Fill out the contact form below right here over on podcastcity.net/join now and sign up today. Podcast City Network, your top source for independent podcasting. Be creative, be yourself.
You're listening to The Everett Lee Show.
You know, one of the choices of making the movie was that it's interesting when you have a monster and then human behaviors, human characters behaving monstrously. So the bullies played by Bianca and Chiara D'Ambrosio, who were so wonderful to work with, like they have to attack and essentially beat up August in a couple of scenes. And Mike Manning has to slap August in a bunch of scenes. Now, I want to mention that nobody was harmed. Neither human nor animal.
More animal
in the in the making of this film. That's very important to me because I love animals, and there are furry creatures in this movie who may or may not meet a bad end. But the thing I want to say is that when characters are behaving monstrously to one another, the human actors have to essentially be dance partners and be looking out for the other actors. So we had a great stunt coordinator named Matt Kerr. Matt is a very experienced stunt guy. He's been on everything from Michael Bay movies to The Dark Knight, and he was Keanu Reeves' double in John Wick for part one and part two. And Matt was all about like creating situations where the violence looks extremely real, but the actors are extremely safe. I think this is extremely important because I like making movies that are really dark and disturbing and unnerving and uncomfortable. But I don't like it when the actors feel disturbed and uncomfortable. I think the actors need to feel relaxed and free and safe with one another. Right. And so when they are attacking one another and is so upsetting for the audience, for the actors, they are really protecting one another in those scenes. So when Mike and August are playing these games of slapface, they have rehearsed those scenes. They have like blocked out those scenes with a stunt coordinator. They have figured out what every slap means, you know, what different kind, like the different way that you use your hand in a slap will either be a roundhouse or a peck, you know, depending on what it is. And the actors know what they're going to do to one another and know that no harm will come to one another. And it allows them to play the violence, but not live the violence. And I think that's very important because this is a film about abuse. But the actors were not only safe, but were, I think, having a really good time while they were making the movie. Certainly, Mike has very fond memories of Halloween. I wasn't there for that part, but because I'm so used to these actors, like the child actors were so good to work with and their parents were so wonderful, but they came to set very prepared and professional and wanting to play the characters and diving very deep into the world of the movie. And it felt like working with grownups. And yet they are not grownups, they are children. And I don't think I ever really got to see that side of them, but Mike did, which I kind of envy a little bit. I mean, tell him about Halloween. It was I love hearing that story because it reminds me that they are so young.
Yeah, exactly what Jeremiah said. You almost forget that you're working with 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds because you're on set with them and they come so prepared and ready to work that you see them as peers, you don't see them as children. And then we wrapped on Halloween Day. And there was a Walmart near set. So we all went to Walmart and got Halloween costumes. August dressed up as Harry Potter. I dressed up as this green dinosaur. Mirabelle dressed up and Nick Thur, our other producers, dressed up. And we went trick-or-treating. And I'm watching Mirabelle and August skip along the sidewalk with Halloween kits. And I had to stop and just look and watch and just remember like, wow, these are my colleagues on this movie, but they're also children. Having fun at this point in their lives, getting so much joy out of trick or treating, and I'm dressed as a big green dinosaur, and I'm like, this is great. This is great. I get all the fun and the wonder of being a child, but I get the professionalism of adults. These are amazing kids.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. You sound like everyone had a good time filming. You know, filming the movie, and even when the cameras weren't rolling, still having a good time. I like that, man.
The crew were a bunch of people that have been old friends for a number of years, and you felt that. You felt like the crew had your back while you were working, whether you were an actor or the director or producers. Like, they were there for the movie, which was really great. You know, the hardest part for the children was not the monsters or the violence, but there was a scene where August and Mirabelle Lee, who plays Mariah, his sometimes on-again, off-again girlfriend, they had to kiss. More than once in the movie. So whenever they had to kiss, they demanded a closed set, like no parents allowed, nobody, you know, like get everybody off the set who doesn't have to be here. Like it's very hard for them because they're 12, you know, and it's like a kiss for them is like, it's quite a lot. So they were a little bit nervous. I remember I talked to Dominic Civilli, the director of photography, and I said, Dom, I think it's important that we show them, you know, you and I are going to walk over to like where they're going to stand. We're going to hit their marks and you and I are going to kiss each other. And then they're going to know that it's okay to kiss your friend. So I said, Dom, let's go. So he and I walked over, we hit the marks, we kissed each other on the lips. We looked at Mira in August and said, that's what we need. Yeah, and then they laughed and thought it was funny and they realized it's okay to kiss your friends for this movie, you know, for this scene. It's playing make-believe. And then they did it. They were like, they did still say like, you know, only one take, please, you know, or no, we did two. But it was really something. It was like, oh yeah, that's the part that's really hard for them because it's a whole different world than what a 12-year-old is used to.
Yeah. The twins in the movie, they were bad, man. They were bad. And I could see with Mariah and Lucas were trying to fit in, especially Mariah. And she liked Lucas, but she wanted to fit in with the twins at the same time. And the fit in, it's like, follow the leader. And I seen that because I've seen that growing up. I remember growing up in like an elementary school, you know, seeing stuff like that there. And I know it was hard because it's like you can have one, you can't have both. You know, it's like you want to be cool or you want to go with your feelings. And that it just brought back memories there watching that there. And I despise the twins. I said to myself, of like, twins are evil, man. I was like, great casting on that part there because they nailed it.
I love working with Bianca and Kiara. I nicknamed them Kurt Russell because like much like Kurt Russell, they were Disney kids who were really interested in exploring like characters who are dark and edgy and complicated. So that was really great. I mean, they were game. They were willing to dare to be disliked, and I thought that was extremely brave of them. I loved working with them. I'd love to work with them again.
I met those two girls during a board meeting for Boo to Bullying, which is an anti-bullying organization that we were are both a part of. And so I met them with their mother at this meeting to help promote anti-bullying. And here they are playing bullies in this movie. And talking to them, they are the sweetest. They are not like that whatsoever in life. But they really wanted to do this because we had a conversation outside, and they were like, Mike, how much should we do? And I said, you have to go for it because there are people like this in the world, and you need, that is who you are portraying in this world. Like this is, that's the puzzle piece that you are playing today. And, cause I remember being bullied as a kid, and there were triggering moments in their performances for me as well. Like you said, Everett.
Mm-hmm. There were some really triggering performance there. I can remember going to school growing up with twins. At one point in middle school, I had two classes with there was like two sets of twins in my class. There was two sets of girl twins and two sets of boy twins, and it just like one was good, one was bad. I mean, one was, you had a good set of twins, a bad set of twins, which, you know, but any other time I come across twins growing up, they were mostly, it kind of reminded me of that. I hate to say that, but like not that bad, but it was give or take on, you know, who the people are. So it just, yeah, it was the cast was great. Good casting. Tom, you did excellent. There was times I will have to say is where it's like I understand Tom, and then there's like it's like I felt for you, then I hated you, you know, the character.
And it's really interesting watching the audience go on a roller coaster ride with Tom's performance. I had the great fortune of being on a what do you call that? Those watch parties, you know. I was on a watch party for the movie where there was a big audience, and they were wonderfully vocal in their opinions, and really they really loved the film. But you could see the parts where they were on Tom's side, and then when they were not on Tom's side, and you could see them going back and forth and like their feelings about Tom as a character, and that goes all the way up to the climax of the movie. Which, as I said earlier, like I think that we start by opening the door. This film is a horror movie, but I think that by the end of the film, we want to break people's hearts. And I think that Tom as a character and the journey that the audience takes with Tom is a part of that, the heartbreak.
Yeah, it definitely was, man. Went on one hell of a roller coaster ride in there. It definitely was. And you were talking about before there, Mike, where you were upstate New York there with filming. Now, you did most of the filming up there in upstate, and then post-production, because I know when I was talking with Jeremiah before you jumped in tonight, before you logged on, Mike, pretty much the pandemic kind of set things back, but everything was filmed before everything went, you know, with 2020, everything that happened. But how long, much more longer did you have to do with post with the production, you know, with the pandemic being, you know, causing a problem and stuff for the production?
Yeah, I'm almost afraid to speak because I feel like my internet freezes every time. But whatever. Jeremiah, do you want to take this one?
I'll take it. And if you are able to come back, like, it, feel free to interject at any point if Mercury is no longer in retrograde. We shot the film right before the pandemic. Literally, we did our final pickup shots like 1 or 2 days before New York had shut down. So when we're in post with our editor, Katie Dillon, like it was really interesting because we're trapped in our houses essentially, and we're seeing these cuts of the movie, and like working on Slapface during the early days of the pandemic was it allowed us a real creative outlet for all of our feelings, because it was such a tough time in all of our lives. This entire pandemic has been challenging and hard. But like I remember those early days, and I remember like whenever a new cut of Slapface would be turned around, It was always something to look forward to. And then I think it also opened up in us a real interest in experimenting and moving around the pieces in Act One and really seeing what the best way to tell the story was. And I thought that was great. You know, it allowed us the freedom to be expansive and to explore and to take risks and to take chances, which, as you can probably tell from this conversation, is something that I really like. You know, it's like I'd like to explore and I like to find out what the possibilities are. And I like to make, you know, like let's do a radical choice. Like the game of slap face where the two brothers are slapping each other was not originally the first scene of the movie. But the producers and Mike had thrown out that idea and said, what if like that is the first thing that the audience sees in media res, no context. We're going to see the brothers slapping each other. I said, let's try it. And we put it in there and immediately you could tell it was a good idea. Immediately it was artistically arresting. It drew you into the story. It opened up all sorts of questions. You wanted to know who these people were. And then the very next time that you see them in the movie, it's like, hey, bud, have a great day. You know, like, I love you, you know, here, you know, all this stuff. And it's like, I thought they were slapping each other, but now they're being so kind to one another. And that was something we found in the edit. You know, that was something that we found by moving the pieces around, which I'm so grateful. I mean, that's another reason to be grateful for brave, maverick producers who are willing to take a chance and being open-minded about that. So that's something that we did. And Katie Dillon, who's been editing with me for a number of years, she and I talked a lot. And she said that this was one of her best experiences working with a production team. Because, you know, it's, I mean, you know, we've had a lot of times when we did work for hire where like the movie is taken away from you and they cut the film in ways that you don't like. And, you know, oftentimes you're like looking at it being like, oh man, that's not what I wanted to do. And this was an opportunity for Katie and I to work with producers where, you know, many of their choices made the movie better. You know, many of their choices were so brave and so provocative and so exciting. And like when you saw it working, you know, you set your ego aside. You don't say like, oh, man, you know, I'm the director. I do this or that. It's like the best idea always wins. And the only way to find out the best idea is to test it, you know. When we're doing takes, I like to try different things. When we're doing the edit, let's move things around. Let's explore all of the possibilities. So having the time during the pandemic to really sit with the movie and allow the movie to immerse with us and like do a slow cook instead of a fast edit, you know, when you're cooking slow, like all of the, you know, everything gets denser, like all the tastes get stronger. And I found that really rewarding both personally and professionally. And you know, the film, yeah, I couldn't be prouder of the end result and I couldn't be happier with the collaboration with these creative partners, because we really pushed each other and we really tested each other. And we really found that by exploring all of the possibilities and taking bold risks, we could make a better movie. And it was really exciting. I mean, and also like cheered us up during the pandemic. So then, you know, then the first film festival that we did was Cinequest, which was virtual. But even then, you know, it's like, even though audiences are watching it on a monitor, we had such a powerful audience response from it. We won the audience award at that film festival, which I think was like really the launching of Slapface into the public mind as a feature. It was like this movie really took the, like grabbed the audience and shook them and moved them. And it wasn't just a horror film to them. It was an intimate story that was told with compassion. And they really cared about the characters. And then the second screening was at Fright Fest in the United Kingdom. And that was not virtual. That was on an IMAX screen. So the audience is seeing these powerful images. And at the end of the movie, I had friends who were there who were reporting back saying, all right, here's what the audience is doing. You know, when the audience left the theater, my friends and then film critics who I talked to afterwards said people were leaving the theater like tears going down their faces, like crying. And I could only imagine what that must have been like with the, we won't give away what the final scene is, but like when it happened, you know, like the audience was thunderstruck by it and so powerfully moved. And they took that with them when they were leaving the theater. And it was something that people wanted to talk about afterwards. Like, you know, in the UK, they like to go to the pub afterwards. And at the pub, everybody is crying and talking about this. Like, they were like, we thought it was going to be a boy and his monster. You know, we thought it was going to be a fun monster revenge story where the monster kills the bullies or something like that. And instead we were taken on a much, you know, on a much deeper journey internally as a viewer, which I was very pleased by. And like, I'm still very happy with the reviews that we've been getting because, you know, it's like the critics are kind of taking the movie in the spirit in which it was made and like understanding that this is a movie to be grappled with. and this is a movie to be thought about. And, you know, when the characters are asking the questions about, well, who is the monster? You know, it's like the audience really does give that a think. It's like Tom can be monstrous and the twins can be monstrous and Mariah yes. can be so cruel to Lucas. And then Lucas himself can be such an untrustworthy narrator. You know, and sometimes like audiences have said the most sympathetic character to them was the monster, because at least like she was a twisted version of our basic human needs. So that's been really interesting. Like, and I think that the pandemic has put us in a very contemplative space and a very emotional space. Yeah. And I think the audiences are showing up to the movie in that spirit.
I was going to say, I was worried that after a pandemic, somebody, you know, audiences were looking for a feel good story. And this certainly isn't that. Like I think I said earlier, I don't know if it cut out, but this is, to me, this is, it's not a feel good story. It's a feel something story. And we wanted that catharsis. And we wanted sort of, to me, one of the main messages of the film is like, don't bottle it up. Like if you feel something, find someone to talk to, express your grief, establish that connection. And that's what I think audiences are taking away from this. So, you know, I was worried. I was like, after a pandemic, but I think, Jeremiah, you said it so beautifully right now, is that I think the pandemic has made us realize that we can't live alone with our feelings, that we need to connect with people, that solitude truly does have an impact on children and adults. And so, you know, if this movie encourages people to speak how they feel and to be honest about their grief, especially men, you know, you see a brief glimpse of this, of Tom in the bathtub sort of cracking. And that's, you know, a beautiful moment, because you see this man that has lived by toxic masculinity almost. And you see that even he, trying to hold it together, he can't, and he's cracking, and he's shot down by his 12-year-old brother, because that's all that they've been taught. It's just, you know, it's to me, you know, if audiences take anything away, it's like, express your grief, express your trauma, express what you're talking about, or else a witch will do bad things.
Yes, yes. And I want to give a shout out to people viewing, right? Yes, that is. I have some people viewing or listening right now in the chat. Want to give a shout out to David C. Russell from Deathmatch Russell Podcast, my friend there listening. Podbeam user, Mike, did you watch the final product of the movie? Because I know some actors and actresses, they'll watch stuff, you know, behind the monitor during the making of the movie, but they won't, a lot of them will not watch themselves, you know, in the final product. Did you watch the final product that's out now of the movie?
When it premiered on Shudder last week, I had some friends over to watch it, and it was the first time that I had seen the movie in a long time since we edited the movie, and it was really fun to watch it again with a live audience. This is the one of the first projects where it was very much a collaboration from script to shooting to editing to selling, and I'm really, really proud of it. So yes, there are some performances where I don't want to see myself, but to me, this was more of, it was about more than the performance. It was about the whole story that we were all able to craft together. So I had to see it, and I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed watching all my friends become very sad.
Nice. Nice. And yet I don't want to give too much away actually of anything with the ending, because it had me shocked. And I will say, I want to throw this out there, that I walked away. I was sad with how everything went down, but I also walked away and formed my own opinion about it, which I love that, because I walked away and decided, okay, this is what happened. Okay. And I pretty much left it like that. I can tell you off camera, you guys, what I thought, but you'll probably be like, yeah, or no, or what, but I will say this, it's exclusively on Shudder. If you love horror, get Shudder Network. They have a lot of great movies on there, and this one here is exclusively on Shudder. And how did that come about, man? Because I remember seeing the post, because Mike, I follow Jeremiah a lot on social media, especially on Facebook. And when I heard it was a Shudder exclusive, I'm like, whoa, how the heck did this happen?
It was the classic, we couldn't celebrate in person at film festivals, so we sent it around virtually, and CineQuest, like Jeremiah said, the response was great. And then we just sent it around, and it was a discussion of, you know, how can we get this in front of as many people, and also who's going to, you know, make our money for our investors. You know, I had to very much, you know, keep that in mind as well. So Shudder, I mean, they have such great content, and we felt like after a meeting with them that they understood the film, they understood the message, they understood the core. They have such a great connection with the horror audience. And ultimately that just, you know, we found like we trusted them with the movie and you know, to be the home with the movie.
Nice.
Did I cut out? Am I good? I'm almost afraid to keep talking because every time I talk, it cuts out. But I think I finished that one.
You sure did. Yeah, it was great. You've been finishing more. I mean, like, it was very infrequent. So I think that the people watching this, you know, they might have missed like 5% of Mike Manning. But like, for example, just now, it was all there, which is great.
Great.
Yes. Okay. it definitely was great there. I love the movie, and I hope everyone, you know, goes on Shudder, sign up for your 7-day free trial, which you can try out. But if you do, go on there and watch this. Pull this movie up, watch it, because you'll enjoy it as much as a lot of people have. The reviews on IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes. I love the fact that Rotten Tomatoes, last time I checked, gave it like an 86%. So it's
going really high.
And I need to get on there myself and put a review, because the reviews help, because that boosts the movie. And if you do go see it, please, if you do watch it, please put a review out there and to help this movie, you know, get up there in the rankings there. And it's just, this is great, man. I was relieved and finally glad to see that this movie finally came out after everything, man. Because in the last 2 years talking with you, Jeremiah, we've brought up Slapface. The last couple times I had you on the podcast, we brought up Slapface and what the progress was with that and everything. And then when finally having it come out, being able to watch it, I love that. And Tom, your performance, again, loved your performance in the movie, and everyone, the supporting cast, all the way to the editing, Katie Dillon, great job editing, and the special effects from Ill Will Productions. Great, all good movie. I can't say anything else, so I said it.
Thank you. But please go and leave a review, a positive review. Anybody watching or listening to this, please, if you love the movie, IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, positive review really helps us get it out to a wider audience. And then if you didn't love it, then we're not called Slapface. We're called something else.
Oh, great. So speaking of the beginning of the year here, I will say this here. At the beginning of 2022, I wrote down a bucket list of stuff I want to do for my podcast for this year, because as long as I've been doing this since 2014, there were some things I've done along the way and got to do on this podcast. And one of the things that I basically wanted to do was on here was at least this year, get someone from the independent film industry from the world. So I got Jeremiah Kemp and I got you, Mike. So you guys, I want to thank you for helping me knock off two things off my bucket list for 2022.
Yeah, we're here for you.
I appreciate it, man. I definitely do. And speaking of the rest of 2022, what can you guys talk about that you have coming up, or what can you briefly talk about? If you have anything where you have that hush hush thing, if you mention something, they're going to, you know, come at your house in the middle of the night and, you know, put a gag order on you. What do you guys got going on for the rest of 2022 to look out for? Start with you, Mike.
Yeah, I have some TV things happening right now. My character, the Manny, is currently on This Is Us, the final season, so that's kind of fun. And then I'm just enjoying Slapface, being out in the world. A couple of the movies that are coming out later on in the year, and hopefully more projects with Jeremiah. So we'll see.
Nice, nice. Jeremiah, what you get?
Yeah, I would certainly love to work with Mike Manning again. Anytime, any place, any project, let's go. Slapface being at Shudder, we couldn't have found a better home for this movie. We're enormously grateful. Thank you, Shudder. It's a great home for really wonderful genre films, and they offer a lot of different kinds of horror movies too for the audience. Along the festival circuit, there's a short called Draw Up and Stare, starring the great Academy Award-winning actress Melissa Leo and Michael O'Keefe. That's a movie with some ghosts in it. So I don't know if I would call it a horror movie, but it's certainly there are elements of the supernatural. And then I start my next horror feature on March 1st down in Savannah, Georgia. It's my first film down south in the United States. I'm a New Englander, and I'm used to making movies in places like upstate New York. I'm originally from Rhode Island. So going down south is like a whole new world for me. Dominic Savilli and a lot of the crew of Slapface are going to be on that project, and I couldn't be more excited. And maybe, Everett, we can talk about that next time, because we'll be editing that this year, and we'll see what kind of life it has. But it's another monster movie, a very different kind of monster than Slapface.
Yeah.
So I'll have covered different parts of the geography of the United States. Maybe my next one I'll go down to New Mexico, Arizona, or maybe Los Angeles. We'll see. But right now it's going to be Savannah, Georgia.
Oh, nice. Nice. Savannah has a lot of history there. I can tell you a story about what happened, getting lost in Savannah back in 2001 or 2002, but that's for another time.
Yeah, next time, man, we'll talk all about Savannah and its strangeness.
I can tell you about that. With my story, you could make a movie out of that. You can, because I'll never forget that there. But that's for another time and a different day, though. But I do want to thank you. Thank you both for coming on here tonight. And I do want to thank everyone that tunes in and listens to this audio podcast here on Podbeam live stream. And if you have any other services, apps that you listen to the Everly Show on or listen to any other podcast on, I'm available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, iHeart, Amazon Music, and right here on Podbeam. So everyone, thank you. Have a great night. And we'll see y'all again next time for another episode of your Everett Lee Show. Peace.